Okay, well, it's a real pleasure to be here during these two very interesting workshops, and also I'm very grateful to the organizers to give me a chance to describe this work to you today, which I think cuts across both of the workshops to some extent. So this is some work that I got involved with when I was at the University of Birmingham concerning the properties of atomic Bose gases, the ground states of atomic Bose gases in the limit of very high angular momentum when you force them to rotate very close to the trapping frequency. And this work was done, a lot of this work was done in collaboration with Nicola Wilkin and Mike Gunn, who are here, of course. And I should say that they really, it's really Nicola and Mike who started this field and provided most of the most interesting results. What I'm going to talk about today is summarized in one paper that I wrote with Nicola and Mike, and another paper that I wrote myself concerning the effects of Feshbach resonances on these results. So this is what I'm going to say in overview, since I realize that I'm giving this talk as part of the exotic workshop. I should start by motivating the study a little bit and describing some properties of Bose condensates, and I'll do that by comparing them with rotational properties of liquid helium 4. I'll then make contact to fractional quantum Hall systems by showing how, in the limit of weak interactions, we are restricted to states in the lowest Landau level, and I'll explain how ideas taken from the fractional quantum Hall effect let you analyze the situations in which you might expect the ground state to be a vortex lattice or some sort of vortex liquid, some more correlated state. And in particular, I'll show the results that we have explaining or explain why we think that at high angular momentum, we expect the ground states described by the left-hand state and more exotic non-abelian ground states known as the Moore-Reed state or the Reed-Rezai states. Thanks. And then finally, I'll say a few words about how these results are affected if you include interactions through a Feshbach resonance. Okay, so just to motivate the study and to fix some notation, let me remind you about some properties of the rotational properties of superfluid helium. And as we all know, the rotational properties of a Bose condensate are rather interesting. If, as we believe to be the case, we should describe the superfluid wave function in this way, as well, the superfluid flow in terms of some superfluid wave function, then the velocity is given by the gradient of the phase, and so therefore the curl of the velocity, which is the curl of a gradient, is zero, so the superfluid itself must be irrotational. As we know, the way that the superfluid will rotate, if it's forced to rotate, is that it will form quantized vortex lines around which the phase changes by 2 pi, and therefore the circulation is quantized in multiples of h over m. And at the center, the superfluid density has to fall to zero to avoid infinite kinetic energies. And it does this on a length scale of the Heeling length, which for helium is microscopic. It's comparable to the interparticle separation. Then, as was first demonstrated by Hall and Vinen, if we force a superfluid to rotate by rotating the container in which it's held, the way that it will try and rotate to mimic rigid body rotation is that it will form an array of vortex lines with a density nv, an aerial density of vortices nv, that increases with the rotation frequency omega. And this was soon detected by Hall and Vinen using the absorption of the damping of second sound on the vortex cores. But it took another 20 years or so before direct images of the vortex lattice were obtained from Packard's group. So here there are some rather shaky images of little dots, which are showing the emergence of the vortex cores at the top of some container containing rotating helium.
How do they do that? I mean, what's the imaging?
So this, as far as I understand, they trap ions on the core, accelerate them in an electric field, and they hit a plate at the top, so they shoot out the top. So obviously this is an incredibly difficult thing to do, to image a core that's in the scale of an angstrom, which is why it took so long for anybody to actually image this directly. So now, as we're all aware, the recent progress in atomic Bose condensates has given us a new system in which we can think about rotation of Bose systems. And here are some images showing vortex lattices that were formed in rotating atomic Bose condensates. So the first results were obtained from the group in Paris. And essentially what they did was to take a confined Bose condensate, deform the trap to some extent, and cause this deformation to rotate. Essentially, they're stirring the condensate, putting angular momentum into the condensate. Then they make the trap circularly symmetric or cylindrically symmetric again, let the system come to equilibrium with this large angular momentum, and then image the resulting state. Actually, the images are formed after the trap has been released. The system is expanded by 50 or 100 times. But nevertheless, we see these images of an expanded condensate, which contains no vortices, a density suppression indicative of a single vortex at the center, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And then
what happens when sort of initial regime steering it? Is that some kind of turbulent thing, or is it just something which already looked like equilibrium levels?
I'm afraid I'm not.
Well, they drive it. It turns out they drive it close to a quadrupole resonance, which is the trap frequency over root 2, it turns out.
Okay.
And that creates that you get nonlinear surface oscillations, which, and then somehow this through nonlinearity curls around and nucleates the vortices.
Right.
The process isn't well understood.
Yeah.
That's certainly clear that it's associated with quadrupole resonance.
Is there any relationship with this superfluid turbulence seen in Helsinki recently?
No, because this would not be, it settles down after some finite time, like a second or two, maybe less, then it settles down to these patterns. But the details aren't clear.
Okay. So, in a few months later, Ketterle's group obtained these amazing images showing vortex arrays, very ordered triangular lattices of vortices containing 150 vortices or so. Just very amazing images of vortex lattices. So maybe I'm going to say something controversial here, but one can ask the question.
Is that like a dimensional layer?
That's actually an image. The condensate is rather, it starts at.
What about the lattice? Is that a two-dimensional lattice or three-dimensional vortex lattice?
The system, the vortices are rather long, and this image is actually of a slice through that.
It's like a two-dimensional.
Yeah, so this is actually a slice through something with rather long vortices. So one can ask, from the point of view of a condensed matter theorist, what's special about the atomic Bose condensates? Is there any new physics here that we don't have in superfluid helium? Of course, there are many reasons why these atomic Bose condensates are fantastic systems to study rotational properties of condensates. The very fact that we can see images quite as remarkable as the one we just saw is shows that it's a very useful experimental system to study. There are a whole range of other reasons why you can expect to see new physics or be able to probe new physics in these systems. But what I want to focus on from this the point of view of this talk are the last two facts. One is that typically the interactions are weak, whereas in helium we have to think about the helium atoms as strongly interacting. Here typically the interactions are rather weak. And the other fact that I'll come to towards the end is that there's the flexibility to tune the interactions using a Feshbach resonance. So for now let me just focus on the weakly interacting nature and point out that one can quantify this by saying that the S-wave scattering length, which is the appropriate interaction parameter at low energies, is typically much smaller than the mean particle separation. So this has various consequences. One is that the condensate depletion is very small, but from the point of view of the vortex physics, an important feature is that the vortex core size is rather large. So in fact, this is essentially why it's possible to see vortex cores in these previous images, because the vortex cores are rather larger than the microscopic scale in helium. But this does.
Maybe yes. So it seems because of Shankar's question, I think it's useful just to make sure everybody aware of it. This is very unusual geometry. Actually, this car is very long, but it's rotating really like this. So it actually is very hard to rotate it.
It's a cylinder.
It's rotating. It's a very thin cylinder, and it's naively one would think that you have a pancake and rotating it. That actually the experiments that were done on the long cigar things.
And the vortices are like long pencils, basically.
That's right.
But then when you've expanded it, it's like a pancake.
That's expanded. And later, I think he's going to tell you also that's going to,
Okay, but one question that one can raise and one point that one can note, and was noted in this paper by Wilkin, Gunn, and Smith, is that there's a possibility to enter a new regime, a regime that you couldn't enter in liquid helium, where you rotate the system fast enough that the vortex cores now overlap strongly. So if you get the vortices to high enough density that the vortex cores start to overlap, then one can pose the question, what do you expect to find? What are the ground states? Will they still be vortex lattices, or are there other potentially more strongly correlated ground states? And so what I'm going to show in the talk is that there are some strongly correlated ground states, including these non-abelian states, but it's not enough just to get the vortex cores to overlap. As I'll show, there's a separate parameter that enters that controls the physics in these weakly interacting condensates when they're rotated. Okay. Now, the states that I'm going to write down are going to be very closely related to ideas from the fractional quantum Hall effect. So in order to make that connection clear, what I'll do is formulate the problem, and I'll discuss this in a way that makes connection to particles in a strong magnetic field rather evident. So I start with a set of n bosons with a kinetic energy. They're confined in some harmonic trap. For simplicity, I've assumed this is spherically symmetric, but in a moment I'll let it be cylindrically symmetric around the rotation axis. Then there's repulsive interactions between the particles, which, as usual in this field, are represented by a delta function contact interaction with a strength that's chosen to reproduce the S-wave scattering length, AS. Then what we want to understand are the properties of the system at high angular momentum, or equivalently, we can think about looking at the ground states of the system in a rotating frame of reference, where the appropriate Hamiltonian is the non-rotating Hamiltonian minus omega times the total angular momentum. So let me just include this rotation looking at the one-body terms. I have the kinetic energy, the trapping potential. I have the rotational term coupling to the angular momentum. And then I'll rewrite that in a way where I absorb this term into the kinetic energy. This generates an omega squared term, which I have to subtract off. And when I do that, I'll assume that the rotation axis is along the z-axis. So I subtract off omega squared in the xy plane. And now I've allowed the trapping frequency in the xy plane to be different from the trapping frequency along the z-axis. So what you can see, once I've written it in this form, is that there's a very close analogy to particles in a magnetic field, because this looks like the vector potential for a magnetic field. If we take the curl of this, we find that it looks like some fictitious magnetic field times some fictitious charge, which is given by twice the mass times the rotation frequency. And also, so this is telling us that we've got something that looks like a magnetic field, and basically all it's saying is that the Coriolis force in the rotating frame is just like the Lorentz force in for a charged particle in a magnetic field, and the Hamiltonians have a one-to-one correspondence. The other effect is this loosening of the confinement in the xy plane due to the centrifugal forces. And so you can see that if, as is the case in the weak interacting limit, one looks at rotation frequencies that are very close to the trapping frequency, then you have a system that's essentially two-dimensional in a magnetic field, because we have rather weak confinement in the xy plane, but strong confinement along the z direction. And in fact, the limit of weak interactions that I'll be studying throughout this talk is when we imagine that the mean interaction scale set by this interaction constant eta times the mean density is small compared to the trapping frequencies, the transverse trapping energy and the longitudinal trapping energy. And in this limit, one's allowed to restrict single particle states to, well, firstly to two dimensions, because the motion along the z-axis is frozen out once we assume that the interactions are weak compared to this energy scale. And also in the lowest Landau level states, that's the lowest Landau level states of a particle in a magnetic field, turn out to be sufficient to describe the rotational properties of this system, provided the interaction scale is less than h bar times the transverse trapping frequency.
So this is the Hamiltonian for the vortices. This is not a macroscopic Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian for the vortices themselves.
No, this is just for the bosons. Everything's in terms of
so
bosons.
Where is this interaction coming from? Is that a model assumption, or the interaction is really a delta function with this value of eta very small?
Well, this is a standard
standard hardcore
approximation to reproduce the. We have particles that are very low energy, and so their wavelengths are large compared to the van der Waals radius. And then the only remaining scattering terms is the S-wave scattering term, and this is a scattering length. And so this is the standard approach in which one can include that.
And it just happens to be small. I mean, that's not an assumption. I mean,
no, this is an assumption. This is an assumption. Oh, okay. So if we assume that we have weak interactions and that the density is low enough that we're in this limit, then we can restrict to these states.
But is it in reality?
In those experiments that I just showed you, it was not the case. The fact that, as I said, the condensate is rather long, it's actually rather dense in those systems, this condition wasn't satisfied. In fact, one can show that this condition is the same as saying, that it's less than the transverse trapping length is the same as saying that the vortex cores are very large and the vortex cores are overlapping. In the experiments I showed you, that was not the case. They were not in the regime where the vortices were dense enough that the cores were overlapping. However, there have been subsequent experiments that have got into that regime.
As you rotate faster, the density goes down.
That's right. That's right. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to restrict to two dimensions, so z is no longer in the game, but I'm going to reintroduce z as a parameter, a complex number that parameterizes the xy motion. Okay, so it's x plus iy divided by the natural length scale, which is the transverse trapping length scale. Then the basis states that we have to consider, a basis state with angular momentum m is given by z to the m, e to the minus z squared over 2, which is the standard lowest lambda level form. Yes?
Nigel, it looks like the length scale that you introduced has nothing to do with the magnetic field, which would be the case for the quantum hole, naturally.
Okay, well, one
so
has...
Does it make any intuition different from usually?
The reason for this is that one actually has to think about the magnetic field with some remaining confinement. If you calculate the length scale that you would find for this frequency with this particular confinement, you'll find that it's this L perp. In fact, it makes sense that the states are, the frequency itself is not important for defining what states are relevant, because the states that are relevant are just those of a harmonic oscillator, and the natural length scale is L perp. This rotation frequency is a helpful way of thinking about how you're, it's like a chemical potential for the angular momentum. It's not changing the underlying states, it's just saying that you're favoring some states over another.
What is L perp?
So L perp, I haven't defined it. It's h bar over mass, square root of h bar over mass times the transverse trapping frequency. It's just the length scale of the harmonic oscillator.
This is exactly the same in 2D semiconductor systems. Also, if you put a parabolic confinement potential, this is exactly the effective
gain. Exactly. That comes in, that's right.
And you are in a
that's
regime
right.
where, yeah. So this is no different.
You can but magnetic lengths in quantum hole samples, which is 100 angstroms.
Yeah.
Important thing.
Right, but formally the same thing, because formally you can think of the two-dimensional electron gas in a parabolic confinement potential in the xy plane, and then the link that will come in is this L part, basically.
That's
combination of magnetic field and the parabolic confinement.
Yeah. What you need to take is you need to take the sum of the squares of this cyclotron frequency and this frequency, and here those cancel, and we just get omega perp squared. So it's just omega perp that sets the scale of the states. Okay, so I've just added a comment at the bottom that one can, of course, consider situations which can be relevant experimentally, where you can imagine that the interaction scale is smaller than this transverse trapping scale, so you're in the lowest lambda level, but still large compared to the longitudinal one, in which case you have a three-dimensional problem, and this was discussed by Jason Ho in this paper. But I'm going to concentrate on the 2D limit. So we still have a problem to solve here. We've restricted the single particle states down to this, but we still have an interacting problem. And what we want to know is the ground state at a given value of the total angular momentum. And in fact, this poses a problem much like the fractional quantum Hall effect, because we can distribute that angular momentum between our different particles. All of those different distributions have exactly the same kinetic energy, because it turns out that the kinetic energy is just in this lowest lambda level limit is just set by the total angular momentum. So if we fix the total angular momentum, the kinetic energy is invariant under the different distributions of angular momentum between the individual particles. And we have to lift that degeneracy through these interactions. And the way that that degeneracy is lifted contains all of the physics about what the rotating ground states of the system are. So we still have to solve this interacting problem. And just as a first step, let me mention one thing that you can do that's a very sensible thing to do indeed, is to do mean field theory, which in this context is Gruss-Potefsky mean field theory, which was done in this particular 2D lowest lambda level context by Butz and Roxar in 1999. So here what you do is you assume that you have a perfect condensate, that is your many particle wave function is just given by a product of all particles in the same condensed wave function psi, and then you minimize the expectation value of the energy to find the best condensed wave function of this type. Now, in the lowest Landau level limit, it's convenient to note that you can write the, well, because this wave function it consists only of powers of z, as a polynomial in z times some exponential factor, we can write that polynomial in terms of a product of z minus a set of zeros. So in fact, we can write the wave function in terms of some vortex locations. So z capital zv is a vortex location, and this will let us write any arbitrary polynomial in little z. There's, of course, this exponential factor, which always comes in. That should be over 2 because of the length scales I've used. I don't know why it's 4 at this point. But from now, I'm going to drop those because they always appear. So then what you need to do is minimize, or essentially, over the vortex locations. And this was done by Butz and Roxar. But here I show some results that Stavros Kamenias has obtained recently at large values of the angular momentum. And really, without any surprise, you can see that you end up with something that looks like a vortex lattice. The vortices, which are sitting here, try to avoid each other. And you get something that's very close to a triangular vortex lattice.
I mean, silly question. You might have said it already, but where is the vortex core size in the
Okay. Sorry, that's a good question. So the vortex core size is now essentially, the healing length is essentially infinite in this limit that we've chosen. So the only length scale is the distance between vortices. So there's no intrinsic length scale other than the separation between these vortices. It's just a set of dips from one vortex to the other.
Where's the classical turning point?
I mean, when does the wave function start becoming evanescent in those pictures? Is that where it goes black?
It's essentially here. I mean, it falls off very sharply. It's close to a Thomas Fermi profile, as has been discussed.
So in this system, healing length is actually not the healing length of density.
Well, when I say healing length, if I define the healing length to be 1 over the square root of n bar times the scattering length, then that is formally infinite. That's a weak interaction parameter.
The healing length is a length scale over which the density variation recovers the equilibrium state. But in this system, it's not the case. Because it's much larger than the core size.
Yes, so there's, I'm not sure what else to say.
There's only one main scale.
That's right. There's no length scale other than the trapping length scale. That's right. And the size of the cloud, which is set by angular momentum or other macroscopic scales. Okay, so this is a mean field theory. And of course, if we're looking for correlated states, we'd better do something more exact than that. So let me turn to mention some exact results that are known for this particular model. Here I've written down, sketched out some of them. So the first thing to note is that because we've got a conserved total angular momentum, it's helpful to classify the different regimes in terms of the values of this angular momentum. And it turns out, even though this isn't going to be a regime that I'm going to talk about in too much detail, it turns out that one can write down analytically what the ground states are for angular momenta up to and including an angular momentum equal to the number of particles. So all the way from zero angular momentum up to 1 unit of h bar per particle, one can find the exact ground states, and I'll just write down one of them, which I think is very appealing. This is when we have the angular momentum just given by the number of particles. It looks like a condensate. It looks like all of the particles are condensed into a single vortex around some coordinate zc, and this would be this would be a condensate if zc were just a pure complex number. But in fact, zc is the center of mass of all of the particles, so it's actually a function of all the other little z's. And so this isn't formally a condensed state, although in the limit of a very large number of particles, the center of mass becomes fixed to 0, and then it does become a condensate. Now, another limit where one certainly can't get pure condensates is if you think about very high values of angular momentum, larger than n, n minus 1. And here, one can see that the Laplan state, or the, at higher values of angular momentum, the Laplan state with quasi-holes is the exact ground state. So here I've written down the Laplan state for bosons, where I have I take all pairs of particles, raise the difference in their z-coordinates to the power of 2 to give overall symmetry. And so what you can see is that this wave function is a wave function that vanishes whenever any two particles come together, and therefore it's an exact zero energy eigenstate of this two-body contact repulsion. So clearly that's an exact ground state. Now, anything in between there, as far as I'm aware, there aren't any exact analytic results, and all of the exact results have been obtained by numerical exact diagonalizations. These were first done by Nicola and Mike, who showed that there were, in addition to the left-hand state, there were a series of other strongly correlated ground states, which one can think of as vortex liquids, as opposed to these vortex lattices, which one can think of as condensed states of bosons bound to some vortices of the many-body wave function. So this, of course, one can think of the Laplan state as a condensate of some composite boson, where you have a boson bound to two vortices of the many-body wave function. Now, we've also...
Just a question, I mean, how far are the experiments away from... years, decades?
Time scale, I don't know. I can tell you the filling fraction. Yeah, I'll come to the filling this filling fraction. You want a filling fraction of about 1. Yeah. At present, they're about 500.
About 500.
Right. But 2 years ago, they were 10 to the 4. Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah, well,
not 500.
Okay. Well, now there is a Fishbach resonance, which they can reduce the scattering length close to zero. So even though the density is high, in terms, it can be as much as you want, in principle.
Right, but we still need the filling fraction is enough.
I mean, you want low density and incredibly quick rotation.
That's right. It's high angular momentum. We need the angular momentum to be of order, the number of particles squared. That's the problem.
Well, Nigel made you. I don't know if you're aware of it, but you probably know that Paul Giller and ENS, it's a very clever way to get into this regime is that they have a rotating concept, they try to chop it into pieces with the optical lattice, which looks now, sounds like a much like HTC now. And then one can show that by doing so, then when they can actually increase the angular momentum density, so it basically reduce number of each section. And it's being pursued at the moment.
That's the triangle so beyond 500. 500 was even before you started chopping it up. So, so what I was, I don't want to go through this discussion of these states in too much detail here. We've shown that you can understand many of them in terms of using conventional theories for conventional fractional quantum Hall states, the sort of we can get a sequence of Jane states by taking a composite fermion wave function, which is a boson bound to a single vortex, and then projecting that onto the lowest lambda level, and you find that you have very good overlaps with the exact ground states. I don't want to go through the details of this here because I want to get on to talk about these more exotic non-abelian states. But let me just...
Nigel, are there analogies to this bubble and the stripe states between high lambda level? I mean...
So here we're high filling fraction, but these are bosons, so the bosons can all be in the lowest lambda level. So there's no equivalent analogy of going into the higher lambda levels.
So the high lambda level you see them coming at all.
No.
So they just become crystalline networks.
That's right. So, but it's an interesting regime where you can have the filling fraction much larger than 1, but still be in the lowest lambda level. So
it probably helps in the filling fraction with vortices, I guess, particles per vortex.
Yeah, I haven't defined it. I was just about to say that obviously the fractional quantum Hall physics is important, and we should understand what the filling fraction is. So, I just put up a slide that explains that. So we want to understand what the filling fraction is, and it's instructive to construct this. And you can do it using what I've the way I've set things up. One can say that in the fractional quantum Hall effect, our filling fraction is the 2D density of electrons times h over eb. where B is the strength of the magnetic field. So here, if we just lift what I was saying before, I want you to think about the filling fraction as the 2D density of vortices. That's the integral of the 3D density along the Z direction, and then divide it, well, multiply by H over Q star B star, where this is the effect of charge and magnetic field I discussed before. And now one can write this in a suggestive way by noticing that the 2D density of vortices for a system of quantized vortices that's trying to reproduce rigid body rotation with angular frequency omega is given by 2m omega over h. But this, if we use the identification of q star b star with this factor, we see that this 2D density is precisely the factor that's appearing here. So the filling fraction in this context one can view as the ratio of the 2D density of bosons to the 2D density of vortices, or getting rid of the areas, we can view it as the ratio of the number of particles to the number of vortices. So in those experiments from Ketterly's group, there were maybe 100 vortices, there were maybe a million particles, so this was 10 to the 4. So clearly, experiments are going to be most often in the regime of very high filling fraction, and it's reasonable to try and understand what goes on there. Now, what one expects, and what we expected, was that, of course, at high filling fraction, you would get a vortex lattice. And you can rationalize this by thinking about the quantum, well, the stability of the vortex lattice to quantum fluctuations. So using results that Duncan Holdian and Wu had obtained, and I think this drew on work from Fetter in the 60s about the quantization of vortex lines, one can show that the quantum uncertainty in a vortex position is set by the 2D, the typical separation between particles in two dimensions. This is really makes perfect sense. What it's saying is that you can't define the core of the vortex of a vortex line to better than the typical distance between the particles when projected onto the plane. It's just saying that the granularity of the system is important in determining the fluctuations of the vortex. And then you can do some sort of Lindemann criterion saying that the lattice will be stable provided these quantum fluctuations are small compared to the mean separation between vortices, or that it'll be unstable if this quantum fluctuation is too large. And then you notice that the filling fraction is just the ratio of these two length scales all squared. So in fact, the vortex lattice will quantum melt if the filling fraction is less than some critical filling fraction, which one would estimate is maybe 10 or so from a Lindemann criterion. Or conversely, at larger values of the filling fraction, you'd expect a vortex lattice ground state to be stable. So partly motivated to show this transition explicitly in numerics, but also to understand the properties of the quantum Hall states at larger values of the filling fraction, we did some numerics on a periodic geometry. So on a torus, just a rectangle with periodic boundary conditions. And the point of this was to remove the edges of this sample. So we had an edgeless geometry. We could also go to very high filling fractions, but an order of magnitude larger than what had been done previously. And since we put it on a periodic system, if this thing wants to become a vortex lattice, it can break translational symmetry and it can form a vortex lattice. So there are various results I could present here, but let me just focus on charged excitation gaps. So these gaps, this gap is defined in terms of the ground state energy as with n plus one particles. This is the ground state energy for n minus one particles and so on. There are various factors coming in here which are there to eliminate or minimize finite size effects. But if we take the limit of very large number of particles, this reduces down to the usual expression for the discontinuity in the chemical potential. This is the chemical potential to add a particle to a state with n bosons, and this is the chemical potential for removing particles. So if this gap delta is non-zero, it corresponds to a discontinuity in the chemical potential, or equivalently an incompressible state. So this is a way of looking for incompressible states in this boson system. So here I've got a graph showing this measure of incompressibility as a function of increasing filling fraction. This has got a system with just six vortices in it because we want to go up to particle, well, filling fractions of 9 or 10. So we've got 50 or 60 bosons in about six states. And what you can see is that there are a series of incompressible states, and then eventually this incompressibility dies away, and we have here something that's flatlining at zero, which corresponds to a vortex lattice. And there are other checks you can do to confirm that what's happened is that this thing has had a transition to a vortex lattice. So there are two things I want to use this graph to point out. One is that there's a transition to a vortex lattice at mu about 6. I've actually chosen the periodic geometry to be consistent with the triangular lattice. If I chose something that frustrated it, this could actually go out to almost 10 or more. So in fact, this should be viewed as a lower bound for the transition to the vortex lattice. But what's more interesting is that you have a series of incompressible states at filling fractions, which are half integers and integers, all the way up to about 6. Now, these states are not the states that I discussed before, the conventional fractional quantum Hall states that you can get from the sort of the Jane construction and composite fermions and so on. And in fact, we struggled for a while to try and think about what these states are. All of the Jane states, sorry, are confined down to a much smaller value of filling fraction. The states past filling fraction 2 can't be obtained in that way. So we tried.
Question.
Yeah, sorry.
You have these negative delta. It means that this state in between are unstable.
It does. I think that this, the fact that these are such large negative values is a finite size effect.
Yeah.
I think that the, although in principle, I don't since we've got short range interactions, I don't think it's impossible that the energy could have energy as a function of number of particles. What we have are cusps where this delta is positive. This piece in here could, in principle, have a negative curvature. But I think that, but this.
That would be a phase operation, right?
It would.
States.
Yes, this if it was like this, then this would tend to phase separate, yeah, between the incompressible states. But this shouldn't be a large value. This will get smaller. I mean, you could, it should be smooth in between there eventually. Okay, so we want to understand what these states might be, and eventually we were led to realize that very good candidates for these are provided by Reed and Rezai, who'd written down some states which they described as parafermion states. So this is the point at which the connection to non-abelian ground states appears, because these are a set of states which one would say are non-abelian in the sense that their quasi-particle excitations obey non-abelian exchange statistics. So I don't want to get into too much detail about what all of this means, but I ought to at least explain what non-abelian exchange statistics refer to. And what it refers to is, well, we're familiar with conventional exchange statistics, where if we take two particles and interchange them, or and even bring them back to where they started from, then the wave function picks up some phase, and this phase could, if these particles were anyons, could well be some some arbitrary multiple of 2 pi, the fractional multiple of 2 pi. In the case of non-abelian exchange statistics, we have a situation where just specifying the positions of the quasi-particles does not fully determine the state. There are a set of degenerate ground states associated with a given location of the particles. Then, when we exchange the particles and come back to where we started from, we need not end up just in a multiple of the state that we started in. We could end up in a different linear superposition of these degenerate ground states. And so the non-abelian nature reflects the fact that under particle exchange, one has matrix multiplications of these within the subspace of these degenerate ground states. And therefore, since matrix multiplication doesn't commute, the order in which you exchange particles will affect the final outcome that you'll get from your exchange statistics. So, as I said, I'm not going to talk about the non-abelian nature in too much detail. What I want to do is find ground states, and to this extent, it's sufficient to realize that the states that Reed and Rezai had written down.
So the matrix multiplication is not for the wave function. It's for the quasi particle.
It's for the quasi. That's right. It's the degeneracy associated with the quasi particles that's important for the non-abelian statistics.
And the evidence that you actually have these states is what.
It's overlaps.
Large overlaps.
So, 2, 3.
How do you know? I mean,
Well, nu equals 3 involves diagonalizing a 7-body interaction, and I just got tired.
I mean, you take your exact...
The exact ground state for the 2-body contact interaction. We've got these ground states. I construct these states and look at the overlap, and the overlap is big. I mean,
what is the overlap?
Well, I can show in a second. I just wanted to say a few more words about these states first. One thing I want to emphasize is we have a series of states. They're labeled by an integer k, and you can view them as the zero energy ground states of a k plus 1-body interaction. So here's a term which is only non-zero if k plus 1 particles sit at the same point in space. And this is, okay, so it's a fairly sick interaction, you might think, but anyway, that's a perfectly reasonable model to try and study. Here's a ground state, a way in which you can write the ground state wave function. What you should do is imagine that you have the n bosons, the number n is divisible by k, so let's divide or n particles into k different groups, each of which contains n over k particles. And then what we do is introduce Luftmann correlations between all particles in that group. So here I've got particles in group A all have zeros between each other, particles in group B all have Luftmann zeros between each other, and so on for k different factors. Then finally, to make this whole thing symmetric, I have to symmetrize over the different distributions of particles between the different clusters or the different subsets. So you can see that this is a zero energy eigenstate of a k plus 1 contact interaction, because if we've got k plus 1 particles, I'm going to have to choose at least 2 from the same group, right? Because I've only got k factors, at least 2 are going to have to come from the same group. I'm going to get a 0, and therefore the amplitude for k plus 1 particles to coincide is 0. Okay. You can also convince yourself or think that you can see the fact that there's some ground state degeneracy for quasi-holes here. Because imagine that we've got a number of quasi-holes, then I could put a quasi-hole in this subset or a quasi-hole in this subset, and there are lots of different ways in which I could distribute the quasi-holes among the different little subsets of the k different subsets. So that seems to show that there will be a degeneracy associated with the different location, just a set of locations for quasi-particles. I can write down various different wave functions. That's right, but it's different to put one here and one here than to put 2 in the same cluster. That's right. And it's true that one does have to be very careful with this symmetrization, because in fact the symmetrization will introduce linear dependencies between the different states that I've written down. So in fact the number of states I've written down in that way is much overcomplete for the subspace that it spans, and the true degeneracy for the subspace is something that has to be obtained after symmetrization. Mm-hmm. Now that turns out to be a hellish thing to try and do, and I think I don't think it's a very convenient way in which to represent things. As far as I'm aware, the only consistent way to count degeneracies for the general Reed-Rizzi states is to resort to the parafermion conformal field theory from which these states were originally derived.
Can I think of these states as k particles binding to each vortex and that quasi condensing? I'm not. Or is that a different state? I mean, because I have a vortex description, I can imagine k boson binding to each vortex.
I think if you look at the wave functions, and then the one way you can represent it is to think of having k anions, each of which bind together to form a boson, and then that boson condensing. So in the case of k equals 2, you can understand the Moore-Reed state as 2 fermions that bind together into a p-wave state, and that then condenses. But if you go to k equals 3 and 4, you're forced to think about having k anions, as far as I'm aware. But I haven't seen a consistent description of the states in those terms.
This says that, in fact, one can not Luftmann particles in several ways. So as I go down in fact, the at first I larger Luftmann particles, and then they can shrinking smaller and smaller by more and more of them, eventually I get to the point of really locking state and I cannot distinguish the puddles anymore. I think that's what each one of them is a puddle.
Okay, can I rephrase it sort of? Just a simple counting problem. Why is it so that these states are great, they have a relatively large filling fraction?
Why is it that they're great? That's a very difficult question to answer. I don't know. I mean, I'm reporting here that they turn out to. Now, why it is, I'm not.
It's sort of a counting scene, right? It's not like when you're reporting it, and somehow you have lots of number 46, and then you would like to just turn particles together and whatever.
I don't think I've got a good or convincing answer.
I mean, why are these things great when, you know, new is like 3 or something? There are a few 46 and lots of particles, and there should be some rationale that you would like to make this case.
You have too few vortices to go around for particles. You can't stick a vortex in everything on these particles, so you're going to share them out to smaller amounts.
But you can put many particles on each vortex.
If you think about the Lofton state as putting a vortex on each particle, two vortices, you just have enough vortices.
Yes.
So you're going to divide the particles up into smaller groups.
Okay.
I think it's another state.
Okay, so
there is the kind of dual way of doing it, isn't there? Like the Pfaffian, where you actually take Loughlin and start removing nodes, and it induces pairs of particles
that's right.
close together. And there's a way of doing that for these K states.
That's right, but that's
clusters of things being forced together. Of course, they're repulsed. I don't really want to be like that. They end up not hanging mountains to get apart from each other.
But as I said, I think the natural way to view those clusters is clusters of anions in the same way as the. So you can view it as clusters of anions that have then condensed in the same way as the state is a pair of fermions that is condensed. You can view it in that fashion. But the evidence, as far as this work goes, what we can say is that this is convenient because it identifies a dominant sequence. You get k over 2, where k is any integer, so I get a half, 1, 3/2, and so on. We recover, of course, there are special cases. K is 1 is just a Loughlin state, which is the ground state of a two-body contact interaction. K equals 2, I've already mentioned, was the Moore-Reed state, which had been written down previously by Greg Moore and Nick Reed as the first example of a non-abelian state in the fractional quantum Hall. Language, but k equals 3, 4, and so on are the Reed-Rezai generalization of this sequence. So as I said, we get good overlaps with the two-body ground states.
So there is not yet, is it correct that it might have been taken? So there's not yet an intuitive way to see why the exact diagonalization has such a strong overlap with these sequence of states. Why, or in other words, why they are so good for the actual
Well, they do.
I mean, I don't understand the question. I mean, that's a dynamical question. I mean, that's true in the fractional quantum Hall state case also. I mean, you posit the Moore-Reed state, and then you know you have to look at the single potentials of Holden to see whether it's stabilizing a particular situation or not.
Except that, well, I mean, that for example, once one has some understanding of the chain sequence, and then in a certain way looking at it. It seems very plausible now. I'm just talking about even a similar kind of arguments. Why this sequence of state is so plausible? I mean,
Well, I suppose.
I don't think there's any very conclusive argument. You can think of plausible arguments for other types of states, and they don't work.
That's
so it's very hard to give a conclusive argument.
I don't know. I mean, I do not think there is any. I mean, Moore-Reed state, you know, we feel that maybe 5/2 or something, where it may be the. I said it's really a question. That's why it happens to be slightly stable. I mean, I don't think there's an intuitive reason, right? I mean,
they keep more than k particles
away from.
Yeah, but then the question is, why does that state become stable?
Exactly.
That's what they're asking, and that's a quantitative question. You really have to do the calculation and see.
The Loughlin state keeps more than one particle coming to the same place that reduces the interaction.
We can just
still reducing interactions if you keep too many particles.
That's true.
Okay, you asked about overlaps.
Because in the end, this is the experiment. This is the test, right? I mean.
That's right. Well, so the overlaps are, well, they're of order 95% or something. This is actually the modulus. If you take the modulus squared, it's about 90% or so. But this is getting up for Hilbert spaces.
How many particles here?
Well, by the end, so here, well, here's nu equals 3. There would be 18 bosons at this point.
Overlaps are not that big.
Yeah, these overlaps are pretty good. They're not very bad either.
Well,
they're not.
I remember in the early days of high school, Van Hoff, Selgan, once in the comments, how come everyone's got overlap on 99
something? That's what it is. They're not bad. They're not.
If you take. Yeah, that. So by this stage, the Hilbert space is really. One thing I should say is that the three-half state has since been studied in more detail by Reed and Rezai, and in from unpublished results, they tell me that the overlap actually gets larger as you make the system bigger. But that, which is unusual, because you're actually making the Hilbert space bigger and the overlap's getting even better.
Yeah, eventually it'll go to zero somehow and come down again.
No, of course.
Zero eventually.
Of course. But I think that, and also I think the nu equals one state, I think that Duncan had previous results prior to this that showed that bosons at nu equals one should be the Murre-Reed, or well described by the Murre-Reed state.
Are there special degeneracies?
There are. On,
have you checked those?
I mean, on the torus.
So,
there are. So here, there are degeneracies in the torus. The degeneracies don't really emerge that clearly. I mean, talking to Nick and Ed Rezai about the three-half state, they say that their overlaps are improving, and they can see the states that should be degenerate are approaching each other. But there's still, you know, there's a ground state, there's a state that should be degenerate, there's a continuum, and it's maybe 30%. Away from the continuum. So it's not really, I mean, these things have got quite large correlation lengths, and you're really on the limit of trying to prove it in numerics. Okay, so that's, okay.
So the exact degeneracies for the model potentials, which are
for the Reed-Rezai. Yes, sorry, for the Reed-Rezai states, those are exact degeneracies. So I'm, I can find those, of course, numerically. But okay, so that's all I wanted to say about the two-body contact interaction. I wanted to say a few words about how this story is affected if you include a Fischbach resonance. I'll just go through this reasonably quickly. The Fischbach resonance has become big news recently, especially in the context of Fermi gases, where they're used to induce crossovers between between BCS and Bose-Einstein condensation. Here I'm thinking about the Fischbach resonance in the boson system. And the basic picture is the following. We have the open channel, which is the interatomic potential as a function of atomic separation. The open channel refers to the atoms that I've been discussing up to now. And the scattering in this open channel is the thing that we've been describing by the S-wave scattering length. And the Fischbach resonance occurs when there's a different spin state in this so-called closed channel, which, while it is not free at large distances, could have a bound state which can be tuned through the resonance. Then, because of hyperfine interactions, there is some mixing between the molecular bound state and the open channel. And so as this level is tuned through the zero energy of the open channel, the S-wave scattering length for the open channel goes through a resonance of this characteristic Fischbach form. So this is of use experimentally because the different magnetic moments of the two channels mean that you can tune this resonance with a small magnetic field, and so experimentally they can tune various atomic species through these Fischbach resonances. Now, a model that's been introduced to describe this theoretically is written here, where one has introduces the molecular state explicitly as a molecular field operator M. This A is the atomic field operator, and then here we've got the molecular energy delta. This U AA over 2 is the contact pseudopotential that I was calling eta before, but I'm now calling it the atom-atom interaction. And then there's some hybridization between the molecular level and two atoms. Described by this constant G. And it's a natural question to ask, what are the consequences of this sort of interaction on the correlated ground states that I just discussed? So just to say very quickly, in the last couple of minutes, it turns out that one can find some exact ground states of a model based on this. And here's the lengthy model that I've written down. I have a Hamiltonian. I break it up in this way. I take out the total number of atoms and the total angular momentum, which are just constant external control parameters of the theory. And then I have these various different interaction terms, energy terms, sorry. There's the kinetic energy, which is the kinetic energy of the atoms and the molecules relative to their zero point energy. So this is just the atomic kinetic energy and potential energy, molecular kinetic energy and potential energy, and these are the ground state energies. This HF is the Feshbach scattering term that I discussed before, which has atom-atom scattering and hybridization into the molecular level. And then finally, I've introduced some atom-molecule scattering terms and molecule-molecule scattering terms. So actually, as has been emphasized to me by Duncan Holden, one should be a little more careful about how one regularizes this model on short length scales. But I'm just going to proceed with this model for simplicity of presentation. You can trust me that there is a regularized version for which these results hold true. Or alternatively, you can think about projecting all of these operators onto the lowest lambda level, in which case everything will go through as well. So the strategy here is to look for exact ground states by finding regimes where these three terms are separately positive semi-definite, so their minimum eigenvalue is zero. And then if we can identify states which are simultaneous zero energy eigenstates of all three, then they're certainly the ground states of this Hamiltonian for a given N and L, because there's no better energy than zero for a positive semi-definite Hamiltonian. So to make the things positive semi-definite, well, first, the kinetic energy is positive semi-definite by construction, because I've just subtracted off the zero energy, the ground state energy. The this interaction term is positive semi-definite as long as I assume that UAM and UMM are repulsive, which I will assume. And then finally, this term is positive semi-definite provided this combination G squared over delta is less than or equal to UAA. So let me just quote the results that I find without going through any of the details. The first result is if we say that G squared over delta is less than UAA, the result's fairly trivial. This is a situation where the Feshbach resonance doesn't, leaves the two-body scattering repulsive, and then all one can say is that the Laughlin state for atoms is the exact ground state at nu equals 1/2. This is kind of straightforward, that this is a state that avoids two-body scattering, and there's no point in having two bodies on top of each other because there's a repulsive contact interaction. On the other hand, if you consider tuning the Feshbach resonance to the point where the two-body scattering vanishes, so G squared over delta is UAA, then, as I say, the two-body contact interaction vanishes. We now have effective three- and four-body contact interactions because two atoms can hybridize into a molecule. This molecule can hit another atom through the atom-molecule interaction, or two molecules can collide. And therefore, we have effective three- and four-body interactions. And here, what it turns out is that the exact ground state at nu equals 1 can be formed from the Moore-Reed state. That's this non-abelian state at filling fraction 1, or the k equals 2 value of the Reed-Rezaei sequence. And the way you do it is to take the Moore-Reed state for atoms and apply some operator R, which destroys pairs of atoms and creates a molecule. So the exact ground state turns out to be some mixture of atoms and molecules, where the atoms and molecules are just hybridized in just the right way so that they avoid two-body contact interactions entirely. But they want to avoid the three-body contact interactions, and they can do that if they adopt this particular state formed from the Moore-Reed state.
Isn't here, I suppose, kind of a practical problem that where you have these sort of three-body or four-body things going on, that the whole condensate could collapse and return it to basically a little puddle of liquid sodium or something, solid sodium?
Yes, no, there is a question about how that would occur. I mean,
these atomic condensates are highly matter stable, right? The ground state is really a fairly cold piece of crystal of atoms.
Yes.
Right, and I understand that it's basically protected by the fact that 3 and 4 particle collisions are very, very rare. And here you're living basically for
right.
3 or 4 particle collisions.
Right. Right? If there, okay, it's a question as to.
It's still like two fermions turning into a boson, so it's still two particles.
Yeah,
yes.
Two boson channels.
Yes. It's a good question. The question is what happens in practice if we have a molecule atom scattering. Are there inelastic processes where that molecule will be inelastically scattered? And that, I think, it may well be true and may well be a problem for the physical relevance of this model. However, I'm saying that within this model, if one can neglect these inelastic processes under atom molecule collisions, then, which is the model I've written down, then this is the ground state of that particular model.
In the first case, is there no molecular occupation despite?
In the first, yes, there's no reason to hybridize to molecules. There's no advantage. Sorry?
Even virtually.
At a filling fraction of 1/2.
There is interaction into a molecule. You have to be in contact to turn into a molecule. You never get into contact.
Once the Lofton state is realized,
right. But what I'm saying is a bit more than that, which is that at nu equals 1/2, the Lofton state is the ground state. That's it. It's not that there's another state that one could envisage that has got lower energy where there are contacts and so on. That's the whole story. That's
it. So the contact direction is also, all the direction is also zero
it's a zero energy eigenstate of everything, including all interactions. That's right. So I think it's so the Moore-Reed state was originally written down as this example of a non-abelian ground state. At the time, they wrote down some really evil Hamiltonian that you wouldn't even want to look at that it was the ground state of. It was then later realized that it was the ground state of a three-body contact interaction. I think it's rather remarkable that it turns out to be the exact ground state, or to describe up to this rotation the exact ground state of a model that's very that one would write down. Rather quickly in the context of these atom molecule interactions with the Feshbach resonance. So that's everything I think I should say, since I'm out of time.
In the Moore-Reed state, when you put three particles together, you have a zero, right?
Yes.
But this means that three-body recombination rates would be zero.
It's true. This particular state, but it's
also the
it would be a little unfortunate to say that this is the ground state just because any contacts made the particles fall out. I mean, you'd
stabilize this filling.
I suppose that's true. If you're exactly at this filling, that's the only state left. That's true. Okay. Let me just put up very quickly the experimental status. So this was already mentioned before. The pictures I showed right at the start from MIT group were in the regime where you had the vortices weren't overlapping yet. Results from Eric Cornell's group have managed to get into the regime where the interaction scale is less than the effective cyclotron frequency, so they're into the limit that you would call the lowest lambda level limit, at least approximately. But they're still at filling fractions greater than about 500, at least that was the last report that I heard. And so they're very much into the vortex lattice phase. So in order to get into the regime of these quantum melted vortex liquids, or these correlated ground states, one needs to reduce 500 to something less than about 10. And then there's a question as to what you would look for, and there have been various proposals as to what one should aim to look for in that situation. But let me just put up a summary, since I'm already over time. I apologize for that. So the summary is that in the limit of weak interactions, when vortex cores overlap strongly, a system of rotating bosons is restricted to states in the lowest lambda level. So an important parameter characterizing the ground states of this at very large values of the angular momentum is this filling fraction, which is related to the ratio of the number of particles to the number of vortices. And then for repulsive contact interactions, our numerical studies show that you have strongly correlated ground states less than about 6, but this could easily be 10. It's a small system. And these include the Lofton state, of course, but also these non-abelian ground states, the Moore-Reed state and the Reed-Rizzi states. And then finally, if one includes this model for interactions via Feshbach resonance, then you can tune the two-body contact interaction to zero, and then the exact ground state of this model at nu equals 1 is some strongly correlated atom-molecule mixture formed from the non-abelian Moore-Reed state. So with that, I'll stop, and thank you for your attention.